ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A young scientist flees Nazi Germany and ends up building the atomic bomb for Britain and America. But behind the lab coat, he's a Soviet spy. Klaus Fuchs, the physicist who decided the fate of the world and gave the West's greatest secrets to the Soviets. To hear it, search for The Bomb on the ABC Listen app or look for it on the ABC Rewind podcast feed.
Hello there, welcome to the Best of the Minefield summer series, where we basically do a writer's festival show in the form of a radio show, except this time we go actually live to a writer's festival. Well, Lee Daly is my name, Scott Stevens is my co-host. Do you remember this day, Scott?
Oh, vividly. It was something else. And, you know, there often should be a warning about meeting people whose work that you've read. So many just disappoint. This was not one of those instances. We were joined on stage at the Sydney Writers' Festival by the award-winning Australian author Anna Funder. I should say that her latest book, Wifedom, was so popular that it even made number 17 in Radio National's top 100 books as voted by you. So you all know how I know. Never mind the Bailey Gifford Award. Never mind, you know. Anna was something else. She was a force of nature. We discussed with her the moral problem of profoundly morally tainted artists. And because of the nature of the topic, because we talked about some really troubling behavior for some really troubling people, I should just note as a word of caution that we did get into such topics as domestic violence and child abuse. There's a little bit of strong language in it. So you should please, of course, use your discretion when listening to this episode.
It was a really rich discussion. And the thing I remember about it as well, which may or may not make this more enticing for you, dear listener, is it's basically Scott and Anna ganging up on me, I think, for most of the hour. Do I triumph in the end, or do I get squashed between this intellectual heft? Well, I guess you'll have to judge. Enjoy the show live from the Sydney Writers' Festival.
So we have done this topic of what's being described as morally tainted artists. I'm going to register my objection to that description in a moment. We've done this before. Last time, it was a problem to consider. This time, I'll confess, I feel real sadness about it.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Why is that?
Not sadness that we're doing the topic, but a kind of melancholy has settled in.
Have you lost some art that was dear to you? Okay.
Yes. And I'm trying to wrestle with why that is, whether that should be the case. And it's also important that we do try to demarcate as much as we possibly can. What is it? At what point does an artist reach a point in their lives, in what we find out about them, where it's not just their work is tainted, as if there's a little stain on a portion of the fabric, as if there's a little something that's come out that we wish we didn't know, but it's almost as if a corruption has come to seep through the entire product. I used this analogy before. I don't know if you like it. It's almost as if someone that you trusted, a lecturer in philosophy or a politician, for instance, said to you, come on, said to you, every 10th thing that I'm going to say to you will be a lie, or one out of every 10 things that I say to you will be a lie. It puts you on edge from the very beginning. Every single thing that's said, you're wondering, is this the one that's going to lead me astray? And there's certain forms of art, artistic production, and here I think we're including writers. We might want to include philosophers. There's something that we've discovered about their lives that makes you distrust not just the internal quality and character of their work, but the ability of that work to show you something true about the world. In other words, you've seen something that makes you think that their aesthetic vision might be jaundiced, might somehow be corrupted. That causes great sadness.
I never had you picked as a P. Diddy fan, Scott, but apparently that's where we are. I think it might be useful to begin, not so much for your sake, because I think you're approaching it in a way that is contained and pretty clear, but more for the sake of, I think, the broader conversation, to delineate some things.
Great.
Because I think a whole lot gets thrown into this one question, which we're calling for shorthand the tainted artist question. That don't necessarily belong together in the same, they shouldn't be considered in the same way. So for example, I think there are those who are in your situation, as you've described it, where someone whose work they hold dear, not just because they like it, but because it somehow penetrates to their soul.
Love is the right term to use.
Right. Now, love might even be too thin, actually. But anyway, that's another debate.
Depends what you mean by love.
Yeah. But someone whose work you value in that way turns out to be something other than what you thought in such a way that you just can't help your reaction to the work. It is forever changed and you are now in a state of mourning. There's that. But then there are the other set of responses or considerations, I think are quite a different phenomenon, which is where some figure does something or, importantly, is alleged to have done something whereby there is either a growing consensus or a subculture of social pressure that then makes it somehow, let's say, performatively morally retrograde to enjoy.
You're not supposed to enjoy.
You're not allowed to.
You're not allowed to.
Either, like, yeah, through some form of social pressure. And here I'm thinking of, I don't know, putting on a Michael Jackson song at a dinner party or something like that. I use that because that's a common sort of, people confess these problems to me all the time, right? I'm fortunate that I grew up more as a rock fan and rock stars are pristine. But I feel, but there is this thing that I keep coming across, which is not your problem. It is people who really enjoy the work of an artist and find themselves still enjoying it and then bashing themselves up morally, or at least not bashing themselves up morally, but figuring out how they can start their own secret society for the enjoyment of said artist's work. And there you're looking at a kind of, I mean, I don't want to use the word cancellation because I think that connotes a whole different conversation, you know, that we've had elsewhere. But it's almost like a kind of boycott as social performance, or as moral stand, or perhaps as act of solidarity. It's in some ways inflected as a political thing.
Yeah, there's often an economic dimension to it as well, though. I don't want to contribute to any money going back. So does that mean if I borrow someone else's disc?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Or if I watch a Roman Polanski movie on YouTube, for instance.
Right, or if I listen to a streaming service where they get 0.0001 cent per play, am I really? All this sort of stuff. But interestingly, even when that is the reasoning, it doesn't seem to disappear when the artist has died. So there's something else going on there. So all I'm saying at this point is, these are separate kinds of things, and we do tend to consider them together. And it leads me to a series of questions that I will put on the table.
There is a third category,
okay,
by the way.
Go on, yeah.
And that would just be the artist as hypocrite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, truly, someone who might have an extraordinary moral vision of the world, someone who's very, very dear to me is Iris Murdoch. Her work on the importance of the cultivation of the capacity for moral attentiveness, allowing what you'd call the fat, relentless ego to shrink and shrink and shrink and the moral reality of others to grow and grow and grow. She's done work like nobody else in the world, certainly not in the 20th century, on that particular moral vision. And she was someone who betrayed people, including her own husband, horribly. In her own dealings, she was an egotist.
Perhaps that's why she knew so much about the fat, relentless ego, though.
It could very well be. And so just because someone is hypocritical, does that necessarily disqualify their work from our own consideration?
Okay.
Or does that then mean that they are in the same position as we are, being addressed by a command outside of themselves that then they're trying to aspire to?
Okay, so that's the taxonomy that we've done.
Good.
All right, good. Now, there are, I think, a series of questions that just occur to my mind as we go through this. I'm not going to answer these so much as put them on the table, and then we can consider whether or not, to what extent they're even relevant. I think they're relevant in a lot of cases, particularly in that sort of boycott by social pressure, taking an observable moral stand to others, etc. case, more so than the others, but they might be relevant. And they are these questions. One, what exactly are we doing when we decide we're not going to consume, or we should not consume, some piece of art? What are we doing? Are we seeking to punish? Are we seeking to demonstrate something to ourselves or others about our own moral fiber? Are we communicating something? Are we trying to achieve some concrete outcome? What are we actually doing? Because I think often we don't even get to the level of interrogating that. We sort of jump to the conclusion, oh, well, I can't listen to that anymore, without considering the what this act would even be. So that's one question. The other question would be, which is related to your monstrosity point, what constitutes a sufficient grounds? At what point, how thoroughgoing, how nasty does the transgression have to be? Yeah. And then the third question is an epistemological one, which is, how certain must we be of the wrongness of the act or acts? Or perhaps to go deeper, because I think we do go there when we do this, the character of the person involved. And this gets really tricky for me, because it goes back to the question about what exactly we're doing. Are we not, in some respect, arrogating to ourselves the right to stand in judgment of a person? Now, you may say that's an entirely appropriate thing to do. Fine, but let's at least acknowledge that that may be part of what we're doing. And if that's part of what we're doing, then the question becomes, how good are we as judges? So are we presuming to stand in the position of God, determining who is blessed and who is damned? Are we forming a prima facie judgment based on best available information that is often crunched through very crude media? To what extent are we obliged to, or do we bother to, acquaint ourselves with the probably limitless complexities of human beings? Can all of those complexities be effaced by the simple horror of the particular transgression? This is a point we've discussed in other contexts many times, Scott. How much would you actually need to know about someone to be able to form a definitive judgment about them? All of those things really are only relevant if what we are doing is judging the character of someone. And I don't know if that's necessarily what we're doing. That's why I put all those questions on the table. But it does seem to me that sometimes that might be what we think we're doing. Mm. And it's a tricky question in every age, but it's an especially tricky question, I think, in our age, which has been inflected, particularly, I think, through online culture, of a rush to form judgments on very complex things and very complex people.
And for those judgments to be seen, for those judgments to be publicized, for those judgments to be performed.
Mm. That's a very different case, I grant you, to the one you're talking about, where it's, I just can't put this record on and enjoy it anymore. And it may well be that if that's the case, that's your answer. It's disturbed your soul. It's almost like this is virtue ethics, or this is understanding moral action as a consequence of pre-existing moral formation. Your response, your decision as to what to do in the face of a tainted artist has already been decided. You don't actually have a say in it at that moment, because it's a product of everything that you've become over that period of time, in which case that's kind of the end of the conversation. But that answer is no good for anyone else. That answer can only, it terminates at the boundary of yourself.
Right. Yeah. All right. We're going to bring our guest on in just a moment. I do want to tease out two important things, though. Mm. From my point of view, I have very little interest in the performative aspect of public condemnation.
Okay.
To say, I want everybody to know that I'm no longer watching Woody Allen movies. Okay, great. I'm really happy for you. But that
No, it's more the opposite, though. It's being prepared to stand in judgment of someone who continues to enjoy them.
Terrific. And that's why you do it. That was Immanuel Kant's great lesson of the moral hypocrisy of acting with contempt towards somebody else. When you are contemptuous of somebody else, what you are necessarily doing is elevating yourself, your position of judgment, so that the other person can seem lower, you therefore seem higher. Any act of kind of public moral judgment, especially when we're talking about standing in judgment over someone, allowing someone's entirely character to be gathered up under the one sign of transgression or of monstrosity, there's something about that that should make all of us hesitant and I believe, humble. It's also, I'm sorry, but you know, that kind of public declaration of who you're not going to listen to anymore, it's only one step more noble, isn't it, than the hipster, well, you know, I only listen to Pearl Jam B-sides, or, you know, okay, I'm really glad for you. But, you know,
except it's morally inflected, it's not merely aesthetic.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But I think what's really important here is to make the distinction between disappointment with artists that we loved. Mm-hmm. I think many people felt disappointed in what they learned about David Bowie after his death, right? There's a degree of disappointment. I kind of feel like I just can't listen the same way anymore. I'm disappointed. What I'm talking about, I'm not sure if you're, what I'm talking about isn't disappointment, but devastation. Not disappointment, but lamentation. I have discovered something. Can I just give an example? Kind of Blue is one of the greatest, aesthetically, objectively, one of the greatest albums ever recorded. The opening notes are tender and probing and curious and gentle and gently persuasive. And Miles Davis was a monster to his first and third wives. By his own admission, he slapped the shit out of Frances Taylor. By her own testimony, Cecily Tyson had to run from their house for fear of her life on multiple occasions. I can't listen to Kind of Blue because the things about it that make it beautiful are ruined by the knowledge of the violence that is behind it. Picasso is one of objectively the great painters of the 20th century. His vision of the world is arresting. But it's also, his art is also a command in a way that very few other forms of art are. His art is meant to seize you and stop you. He is the creator at the center of his own universe. And so when Francoise Gillot says that at one moment in her wonderful, heartrending, heartbreaking book, Life with Picasso, which is at one moment she calls him, I just realized that you're the devil. And he says, and you're my angel, I'm going to brand you, and puts out a cigarette on her face. When she says that the multiple women that he accumulated and devoured and painted and then discarded were reduced by him to, this is her own description, machines for suffering. That part of his creative power that he wanted to exert on the world was the dissembling of the world and then the recreation of the world as he saw it, as he wanted it. And that's then what he did with the lives of his women. I can't see Picasso the same way. It's not just, I would like to be able to enjoy cheap clothes, but I know that they're not ethically made. It's, there has been an aesthetic corruption here.
But that presupposes a nexus between the character, the worldview, the transgression of the artist and the art itself. Now, you might say that exists in every case. You might say it exists in some cases. But the way you've described all of those things, you talk about what is communicated in those first notes of A Kind of Blue. You no longer believe it.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So the work itself changes because of the nexus between what you thought was valuable in the art and the lie that it's telling now.
And it's that it would be a lie.
Right.
It's not just hypocrisy. There's something you learn for this person to be capable of that thing. There is an alienation from the very concept of beauty that must be almost thoroughgoing.
Okay, so we must then hold out the possibility, even in your vision and even in this kind of alienation from the artist, there is a theoretical possibility that the artist's work is so far removed from the transgression, so disconnected from it, that you don't feel that same thing. Would you agree with that as a statement of principle?
Sure.
Okay. Which makes all of this, by necessity, inescapably subjective, which is not to say wrong.
No, it's absolutely
has to be.
Of course it's subjective because it's about we still love the art, but we no longer know how to enjoy it.
Yeah.
We still know on one level the value of the art, but we no longer know within ourselves. We no longer have any confidence in our ability to give ourselves to it and in a very real way to be led by it. Can I just give one final example?
And we have to get to our guest.
And this I need to say is the example that broke me in the last year. Most of you, I hope, would have read or come across Alice Munro. Short stories of the most uncommon truthfulness and vulnerability and exposure. Short stories that plumb the murky depths in the intimacy of human relationships in a way that invite readers to give yourself to her, to allow her to take you by the hand and say, I know that you've experienced these things and I know you're only willing to whisper them in the dark. Stories that suggest a degree of understanding of the way in which intimate relationships can bruise and break and corrupt. And so a degree of wisdom that should make her, one would think, immune from doing the same things to those closer to her. And then we learn within weeks of her death that she herself learned from her 20-year-old daughter, Andrea, that Andrea had been molested by her stepfather, Gerald Fremlin, that Alice Munro found out about it. And after a very brief period of almost perfunctory separation, became estranged from her daughter and welcomed back her daughter's abuser. You don't condemn Alice Munro for that. There might have been all sorts of psychological, and in fact, in Alice Munro's stories, there are the kinds of alibis that you would want. It's not just that she's okay with it. It's that the connection, I mean, if anyone has done anything with domestic violence or helped within domestic violence shelters, you know that the relationship between men and or violent men and women is really, really complex. It's not that we condemn her for that, but it makes you question the wisdom that we always looked for or valued within her own writing. Yeah. It's not that we no longer read her, it's that we've lost something in our ability to give ourselves to her writing.
Understand that. It just depends a little bit on the terms on which you've invested in the first place. That's what I would say about that. And, you know, this is not an entirely applicable saying, but I'm going to apply it. The Arabs have a saying that by their opposites are things known. A lot, not all, but a lot of the examples you give, I think, illustrate this sort of idea. It's the very embodiment of the contradiction. It's the very embodiment of the opposite of the things that are the fat, relentless ego example, or these sorts of things that in some case provide the vision. So then I guess the question is, what are you investing in at that point? Are you investing in the person who produced this as though they are somehow, you open up their soul and there's a light that emanates from it? Or are you investing in what's emerged from that, even if it's emerged from a very dark place? It doesn't necessarily make it less true. And I guess that's why I've experienced fewer of these examples than you in my life. And this could just be that I'm weird. I'm fully open to that. Almost proud of it, but I've never found myself investing in the personality of the person who's producing anything. I don't know why. I never had posters on my wall, apart from ones that were given to me.
And those were entirely of Batman, so, you know.
Yeah. No, they were mostly cricket posters given by, I don't know, cricket training centers who had stuff to give you. I just never invested in it. I think there's an interesting question, which we won't get to today, I suspect, about that, about whether this experience is not so much about finding our response as figuring out what our initial response should have been. Whether there is something wrong in the relationship that we put ab initio into the artist and the production of the art, the performer and the performances, the music, the literature, whatever, the philosopher even. Whether we got something wrong at the beginning. Anyway, that's enough about that. Shall we bring in smarter minds than ours?
Well, actually, before we meet our guests, let me jump in quickly to remind listeners that this discussion includes some strong language. It also covers some disturbing subjects such as domestic violence and child abuse. So please do use your discretion when listening.
You are listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National, which, by the way, you can hear anytime on the ABC Listen app or wherever it is that you get podcasts. Well, Ed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. We're here at the Sydney Writers Festival, which means we have access to the best people, Scott, and one of them is about to join us.
One name we did not mention is George Orwell, and it just so happens.
George Orwell's about to join us?
We have the perfect person to join us. Anna Funder is one of Australia's most acclaimed writers. Her book Stasiland won the 2004 Bailey Gifford Prize. Her novel All That I Am won the Miles Franklin Literary Award in 2012. But it's her latest book, Wifedom, that some of us, me included, are calling her masterpiece. Will you please join me in welcoming Anna Funder?
Hello, everyone. Nice to be here. Although, like, scary. I just realized that this is flawed artists and I'm exhibit A. And also why this show is called The Minefield. So, like, really feels very scary. But
no.
Nice to be here. Yes.
Not at all. Where do you want to take us?
I think you guys are talking a lot about judgment and about being upset and about distancing yourself from artists who have moved you in your case or failed to move you in your case. I feel more, I mean, I understand Alice Munro is a very upsetting thing. I understand these things are upsetting. I don't feel that about Orwell myself, and I've spent a lot of time with him. I feel that there are a lot of vulnerabilities that he concealed, and that it would have been almost better for his writing had he been able to write out of those vulnerabilities than shut them down. There's, in the middle of my book, Wifedom, I write about an essay that Orwell wrote on exactly this issue. So, he's writing about whether we can separate an artist. So if you love their work, if you can separate the sort of art monster from the work. In this case, he's writing about Dali, because he thinks that Dali is a wonderful artist, but as he says, a disgusting human being. And he also writes about Dickens, who was really awful to his wife, and he says that doesn't matter either. And then he writes about Shakespeare and says, well, if Shakespeare came back to Earth tomorrow and his favourite pastime was raping little girls in railway carriages, King Lear still stands. So Orwell is really struggling in this magnificent essay that you can read online with how do I love this work when I know and actually also want to repress what I know about the person who made it. So I talk about that in Wifedom kind of right in the middle of the book because it seemed in a way to be where I was headed. And then I write a scene in which Orwell's wife, Eileen O'Shaughnessy, who wrote emendations on everything that he wrote. So she was a brilliant Oxford-educated writer and editor. And she used to write in handwriting over all his essays. So I imagine that she also edited this essay by the art monster she was living with about what it is to be an art monster. So I thought maybe if I could just read two pages of how I imagine her to be editing her beloved art monster.
Please.
This comes immediately after discussing the thing. So she's in bed because she's ill and he brings her this essay and she's scribbled on it. He can't read the writing. He says, I can't read your writing, he says, handing her the essay. He turns the chair at the desk around and sits down. She picks up her glasses from the bedside table and looks at her comment on the back, then turns the paper over to the typed side. Dali, she reads, so this is his real essay, grew up in the corrupt world of the 1920s when sophistication was immensely widespread and every European capital swarmed with aristocrats and rentiers who had given up sport and politics and taken to patronising the arts. If you threw dead donkeys at people, they threw money back. That was what he wrote. She looks up, eyes glittering. "That's very funny," she says. "Thanks," he says. She looks back at the page. "But that's not it," she says. "Ah, here we are." And this is from his essay again. "If Shakespeare returned to Earth tomorrow, and if it were found that his favourite recreation was raping little girls in railway carriages, we shouldn't tell him to go ahead with it on the ground that he might write another King Lear. One ought to be able to hold in one's head simultaneously the two facts that Dali is a good draftsman and a disgusting human being. The one does not invalidate or, in a sense, affect the other." So that's how Orwell feels. Eileen turns the page over again to check what she wrote. "Disarticulate," she's written on it. "Yes," she says, "very cryptic of me, sorry." The light is behind him, so he's a silhouette of hair, ears, shoulders. But she knows from experience that he's listening closely. This, right here, is where they meet. "What I mean," she readjusts the pillows at her back, "is that there are two ideas here run together. The first is about whether the raping of little girls in railway carriages, or whatever you might have your genius do, somehow fuels him to write the masterpiece." She looks up at him, pushes her glasses up the bridge of her nose with a finger. "The second is how we think about the masterpiece afterwards, when we realise its creator is this disgusting human being, as you put it, or even," she looks over at him, "just an ordinarily flawed one. Do we accept the price, you see?" He seems to find it almost a feeling of physical warmth basking in her attention like this. He fiddles the wedding ring around his finger. "I just meant," he says, "that if Shakespeare had done that, King Lear still stands." "But that's not what it says here," she says. She holds up the page. "You're implying that if a genius needs to rape little girls in railway carriages, that shouldn't affect how we think about his work. And afterwards, we can enjoy the work and disregard the price. Everyone gets what they want," she holds his gaze, "except, I suppose, the little girls." This would be, she thinks, the moment to ask him whether fucking other women fuels his work or his sense of himself as man enough to do it. This is the question both of them know is standing here, shyly, patiently, expectantly, between the bed and the chair, waiting to be asked. Thank you.
Anna, I think this transports us very quickly to the heart of the matter. I have no interest in standing in judgment over other artists. I do regard beauty as being a gift to the world, an invitation, and also a way of seeing the world. Things that are truly beautiful aren't just held separate too. They become also a kind of window through which we are invited to see the normalcy, the quotidianness of the world differently. Which it seems to me means, it may not necessarily follow, I'm jumping several steps here, that one of the things that's at the heart of any production of art, and if we can include Orwell in the process, is responsiveness to the world, is a certain answerability to other people and to the way that things are. And as soon as you have an artist that is engaged simply in the act of creation, as I suppose Picasso was, who dissembled and reassembled, and who did tremendous violence, therefore, on both his own conception of the world and then wanted to impose his image upon the world for people to see. Once there's that unanswerability, once there's that heedlessness, the artist as creator rather than artist as someone who is responsive both to the world but also to others, it seems to me that something catastrophic has gone on within the creative process itself. When it's simply creation and not responsiveness, when it's Orwell projecting a kind of image of himself as someone for others to follow, to see, to be led by, and then conceals the extent to which he is then responsive to the pain that he is quite clearly inflicting on his wife, and maybe the extent to which he is using others. Once there's that absence of responsiveness, it does seem to me that something has happened that has the tendency, the possibility, and the very real potential of corrupting the art itself. So it may be on one level beautiful, but I'm not sure how truthful it can then be.
That's a big question.
I may be wrong.
No. It's a wonderful question. I think we want artists to show us an invisible world. We want artists to show us something inside them that we then find inside us and illuminate the world that way. One way of doing that is to show us the boundaries of our normal psychic and social lives, to go right up to the electric fence of what's normal or acceptable, and sometimes beyond it. So Alice Munro beyond, Woody Allen beyond, Picasso beyond, you know. But I feel like if that's what we want, if, say, you watch Woody Allen movies, it's clear he is signaling really, really clearly in all of those movies that that's what he's doing. He's going right up to the limits of, is it acceptable for me to be 42 years old and sleeping with a 17-year-old? Is it acceptable to want my wife's sister? Is it? You're talking about an artist and social responsibility, but we want danger in art. We want those, we want the limits of our normal lives to be revealed to us, because they might be valuable and important, or they might be silly. You know, patriarchal limits are really silly and dumb and dangerous, so why don't we go right up to them? There are moral limits about how you might protect your daughter from your new husband, you know, that might be more important. And we're making judgment calls on each of those differently. But I feel like you can't blame artists for doing dangerous things and showing us uncomfortable things. I think that's sort of what we're for.
There is a vast difference, though, between Woody Allen on the one hand and, say, Vladimir Nabokov on the other. Woody Allen, I have no sense of self-knowledge. This may be harsh. I'm just saying, watching the films, I have no sense of what Simone Weil calls an interval of hesitation between him wanting who he wants and the possession of what he wants. Mm. I don't get the sense of self-knowledge. As he himself acknowledged, the heart wants what the heart wants. In Nabokov's Lolita, which is in many respects a novel about a monster, Humbert is a cliche. The very erasure of Lolita is the thing that condemns Humbert to his own ridiculousness, his own monstrousness. In other words, the limits of the figure of Humbert is inscribed into the character itself. It's written all the way through with his own monstrousness in Nabokov's decidedly kind of understated way. You're right, we want danger, but we don't want self-deception, right?
Well, I'm not entirely sure that I am completely radically transparent to myself. You know?
That's right.
I'm not sure that any of us are. So we're all sitting here as readers and writers engaged in that inquiry, but certainly in my case, not from a position of absolute self-knowledge. And I think Woody Allen was kind of provoking the world. Just let me see how far I can go, until he did it in real life. You know, I don't know whether that's self-knowledge or not, but it's certainly doing it.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to the best of the Mindfield Summer Series. Waleed Ali, my name. Scott Stevens, my co-host. This particular episode was recorded live at the Sydney Writers' Festival with the, I think I'm going to say, legendary Australian author Anna Funder. And just a warning, if you haven't picked up already, the discussion does include some strong language. It does cover some pretty heavy and dark subjects such as domestic violence and child abuse. So discretion advised. Let's get back to it.
Interestingly, just thinking about Alice Munro, the man, Alice Munro's husband, who sexually abused her 8-year-old daughter for years, then and took a whole lot of photos of her, blamed her right. in letters to the family.
Called her his Lolita.
Right. So even if Nabokov was self-aware, he certainly wasn't writing from the point of view of Lolita, who is now,
right.
her name has been trailed around by abusers all over the world. So, yeah.
I am interested in this idea, though, that we want artists to take us to and then perhaps beyond limits. I wonder if that gets a little bit to what I was talking about earlier about the way in which we choose to approach or invest in art, because that's not the only vision of art. I would argue that's a fairly modern vision of art.
Mm, that's right. It wouldn't be Bach's vision of art, for instance.
No. There's a whole other vision of art which is deeply unfashionable, which is that art is about beauty and the exploration of beauty and the refraction of beauty in as many different ways as possible. That's often not an art that takes you anywhere near limits. It's not art as social critique. It's not art as transgression. And I think what's interesting to me, and this might be a slight detour, but I think there is something odd in the contemporary and probably peculiarly, though not exclusively, Western approach to art, where transgression is like an artistic value. Something that makes art valuable is transgression. I don't know that we think about that enough. And I don't know that we think about the fact that we've brushed something like beauty aside so much. But I'm very taken by your observation, because suddenly it's like, well, of course we're going to have endless examples of these, where that is the hierarchy of artistic value puts things like limit-seeking, limit and transgression at the apex or somewhere near.
I don't think I'm talking necessarily always about transgression. I think, so, and the art that I'm talking about is, or that I'm here as an exhibit of, is writing. The beauty is in the words and the form, but what you're doing is showing, say in Munro's case, emotional extremes, things that are often not said, things that are experienced every day in families or love affairs that are hard to put words to. I'm not talking about transgression for the sake of it. I just mean things that are at the limits of human emotional experience, and they're represented in a way that's beautiful. That's how we can read stories that are monstrous or upsetting or is because they come to us in a beautiful form between covers and the beauties in the language. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really talking about painting.
No, yeah.
And I do think that that has a value. I do think that's the difference between, you know, the Germans differentiate, for instance, between literature, belletristic, and commercial literature on the basis that one of them is going to take you to a place you didn't expect and the other is going to just give you pleasure, you know? Mm. And I think in art or literature, we really want that aha moment. We want that frisson of something that we didn't expect. And when you read something and you're terribly moved by it, it's as if that work has kind of, you've taken the work and the author along with it, because you know it's made by a human so far, a carbon-based large language model like myself. You take it inside you and it rearranges your internal furniture. I'm sure there's a fancy philosophical term for that. I don't know what it is. But, you know, it moves your heart and your mind. And then the idea that someone who did something so intimate to you, who moved you, also put a cigarette out on his wife or whatever, is very upsetting. And I think Richard Ford put this best to me one time. I was in an audience like this at the 92nd Street Y in New York City, and he said this beautiful thing to the audience. He said, you know, I think, and I'm mindful that I'm going to be signing books as well in a minute, but he said, I think people are always disappointed when they come and see me after a reading in the signing queue, because they think that they know me from my work and I am always a disappointment to them. And he said, he kind of opened up his hands and he says, because I am not my best work. And I just thought, in that gap that he opened up in his hands between the man and the work, of which he was aware, I suppose that's the gap that we're talking about. Mm. And that's the gap that the reader invents the writer as this wonderful person because they've been intimate with them. Mm. So they have to be... Otherwise, it's the kind of feeling of violation that you let some monster inside you.
Yeah, but the error is in the thought that you have actually been intimate.
But you haven't, because you haven't had that experience of art, which you just confessed earlier.
Yeah. That's not what I said.
So
that's actually not what I said.
Oh.
What I said was, I've had art move me very deeply, but I don't invest in the artist for that reason.
Ah, you can separate them from the get-go.
I guess that's just how I've taken it in. And I was.
What do you mean by invest, though?
So you've never been in a standing queue and thought, I'll go and meet this author, and then been radically disappointed by them.
I guess
had hopes for them.
I'm just not bothered by the disappointment.
Uh-huh.
Because I don't know how to... I was trying to explain this to Scott before, and I have no real explanation for this, so what I'm about to say is probably wrong. But I think part of it might be that because I've lived my whole life as a minority, I interact with the world as though it has very little in common with the way I see it. And so, okay, I really like this album. To declare to me that the people who make this album have nothing in common with my moral universe, and I accept that's not the same thing as a monstrous act of, but it just does nothing to me because I don't expect them to. So at some level, I think that must be the psychological thing that's kind of separating it. That's what I mean a bit by the false intimacy. I recognize... Part of it might also be I have a similar, although I'm not saying anywhere near as deep, experience from the other side as someone who works in television. People think they know me all the time. I've had people congratulate me for thinking and saying things I've never said or thought, and the opposite, right? You would have experienced this. I mean, I think you've kind of confessed that maybe you have with your in the book signing experience. That's, I think, what I was trying to get to when I was talking about, I wonder about the terms on which we engage with art in the first place, that we attach all these things to it that don't necessarily have to be there, that don't necessarily belong there. The intimacy we experience is false. Doesn't mean that it's not really experienced or it's not moving, but it might be misdirected if what we're attaching it to is the person who's produced this thing. I don't know. All I can see is Scott's disapproving look.
It's very interesting. I've been thinking about this a little in the context of AI and people having AI produced art.
Yeah, right.
So that's not going to bother you at all because you're not interested in the human behind it, and it won't matter to you if AI produces some beautiful thing because it'll still be a beautiful thing. And you are not interested in engaging with the personal creator behind it.
That is actually true.
Because you're... If I'm understanding you correctly.
I can totally see why you would draw that conclusion, and maybe this is an inconsistency in my position, but I...
He's quoted an AI-written poem to me as if it was really impressive.
No. God, welcome to the Sydney Festival of Misinterpretation. The reason I did that was because I don't like the idea of AI-produced art, and I was petrified that this wasn't terrible. And it was more as a harbinger of where this thing might go. I can totally see, yeah, maybe you're right. The logical extension of my orientation should be AI is fine. No, I still retain a conviction, perhaps a hopeless one, that AI-generated art will be missing something.
It's missing the human behind it.
Yes.
Because art is communicating from one human to another.
Agreed.
And that's why we're talking about how we deal with it when we know that that human was, as you say, a monster.
Yeah, but...
Maybe
this goes back to a show we did on evil. I don't believe that we can categorize human beings as monsters or not.
No, sure.
And so,
but art,
it may well be that they are a monster or they've done something monstrous, better way to put it. But that doesn't mean that there's not something true and precious in their humanity that has been transmitted through the art. I can recognize that without necessarily hinging my relationship with the art on some notion of intimacy with this person in toto, such that they become a disappointment to me and ruin the art. Can I say that is the least likely applause I have?
I am so disappointed in you all.
Yeah. What have I done wrong?
I'm not going to. I'd love for you to. But I mean, you've just made certain sort of exaggerations at either end of the thing, both calling the experience of art a kind of false intimacy. I don't want contact with the person who is creating the art, but I do believe that the art has come from someplace. And in just the same way that I would like to think that someone who has lingered with a problem, who has foregone earthly pleasures and dalliances with the frivolities of culture in order to discipline their minds and devote their lives to trying to puzzle out something that matters to the way that we live together, or that is devoted a period of time to rediscover someone who is forgotten within the folds of George Orwell's own biography, I would like to think that the product of those labors has come from some place that at least at some level is both the product of soul, but is also to an extent trustworthy. To say that the product of someone's soul is being offered to me, that's different from a kind of false intimacy. I don't have to know everything there is about the other person. But when the product of that soul has at the heart of it a kind of blind spot, there's a philosopher who I love, Stanley Cavell, who talks about the inability of seeing another person as another person, of imagining that person feels pain the way that I feel it. Imagine that person has depth the way that I have depth. He describes that condition of not being able to see the humanity of another person, a condition of soul blindness. I don't trust someone who is soul blind to show me what beauty looks like, because there is something at the heart of it that involves, to go back to the Picasso example, a disassembling and a reassembling in the image of the creator.
Does that mean that part of your grief is that if this thing you thought was beautiful, you can no longer really maintain is beautiful because you don't trust the soul?
Yes.
Then you've lost touch with what beauty might actually be.
Yes.
That what you've lost is not this artwork. What you've lost is beauty.
That's right. And the fear, what's missing in me that I didn't see it in the first place? Would you like to respond?
I'm just taking that in for now.
Thank you. The other thing that Stanley Cavell said is the really hard task isn't discovering the monsters who live among us. The really difficult task of the moral life is to discover the monstrosity in myself.
Yes, well, okay,
we're
only
human. Okay, you clapped to that?
Well, she did.
Any last words? We can wrap. It's up to you.
It's my show, apparently.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for having me.
No, not at all. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you all for being here. Scott and I are going to take this outside.
He's going to read me some more AI poetry. That's what he's going to do.
And you'll misunderstand why. Anna Funder, one of Australia's most acclaimed writers. Her book, Stasiland, of course, won the 2004 Baillie Gifford Prize. Her novel, All That I Am, won the Miles Rankley Literary Award 2012. Wifedom, of course, her latest book, is so relevant to this conversation, and it's been wonderful to have you as our guest for this week's edition of The Mindfield. We're at an end for this week. Scott and I will patch things up, and we'll see you next.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.